own mad reasons to kill. And they almost always kill strangers. You seem to know a lot about the subject, the sheriff said. I've spent a lot of time around some very good cops. I learned as much as I needed to in order to try to help them. Enough so that it's been a long time since I had a good night's sleep. Her voice was matter-of-fact and without self-pity. Monsters, Ben murmured. She glanced at him. When I was a child, my mother told me that if I turned on a light, I'd see there was no monster hiding in the closet or under my bed. She was always right about that. Then, I'm all grown up now, and the monsters in my life aren't under the bed. They're inside my own mind, where I can't shine a light on them. The sheriff was unaffected by her words. Ever talk to a shrink, Miss Neal? Lots of them. Her voice was as dry and unemotional as his had been. Sheriff, I can give you plenty of references. Testimonials from lots of cops on the West Coast, all of them as hard-headed and rational as you are. They'll tell you that they were doubtful, too, in the beginning. That they also suggested I talk to someone about these voices and images in my head. And they'll tell you that time and experience convinced them that sometimes, not always, but sometimes, I could help them catch killers. She drew a breath, her pale eyes fixed on his. No matter what you believe or don't believe about what I can do, Sheriff Dunbar, there's one thing you can be very, very sure of. I hate this. I didn't ask for this, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It is not a pleasant thing to be jolted awake in the middle of the night with the screams of a dying woman ringing in your ears, and the smell of her blood so real you expect to find yourself covered in it. It is not a pleasant thing to sit across a desk from hard and suspicious men like you and talk calmly about vicious crimes and monsters who can't be banished by the light of day or sanity. And it is more traumatic and debilitating than you will ever know for me to force myself to drop all the guards I've spent a lifetime building and climb inside the mind of something that is not human. So give me a break, Sheriff. I did not kill that poor woman, and since I did not, you will never find a shred of evidence against me. Now, I will give you the references I spoke of, and you can check them out or not, believe them or not. If you want my help, I will do everything I can to help you. If not, I'll go back to my peaceful house and my peaceful life. And the next time I'm awakened by the screams of a dying murder victim, I'll pull my pillow over my ears and try my damnedest to ignore them. Ben looked at Matt, but said nothing. Cassie was obviously her own best champion, at least where her psychic ability was concerned. And if there was ever going to be any kind of understanding between her and the skeptical sheriff, it would have to be reached by the two of them. It wouldn't be easy. I don't believe in psychics, Miss Neal, Matt said. And I don't trust you. That is your prerogative, Sheriff. She matched him stare for stare, and her voice was cool, her steel core suddenly evident. Judge Ryan asked me to help, and I said I would. But I am not going to jump through hoops for you, especially when my help is not wanted. If you think I'm a killer, lock me up. When the next body turns up, I'll have a cast-iron alibi. Unless you do believe it's possible to walk through walls and bars. He ignored that. I don't suppose you have an alibi for last night. The same one you have. I was home in bed. Of course, I was alone. Matt stiffened. Meaning? Meaning you weren't. Ben was surprised, but kept his mouth shut. Nice guess, Miss Neal, Matt said. It wasn't a guess. I don't even have to try very hard to read you, Sheriff. You're an open book. The lady has red hair. I believe her name is Abby. Abby Montgomery. Ben said, For God's sake, Matt, If Gary finds out, he'll come after you with a gun. She's still his wife. They're separated, Matt snapped. Not in his mind. Matt stared at Cassie. You probably saw us together. You've been very circumspect, both of you, she said. Nothing in public. As Judge Ryan said, her husband hasn't accepted the separation. He has a bad temper. It's why their marriage broke up. She frowned suddenly. Be careful, Sheriff. Be very careful. Or you'll never be able to take her to Paris next summer the way you want to. Shit, Matt said, obviously shaken. You couldn't have known that. I haven't even told Abby. Nobody knows. You know. There was a long, tense silence, and then Cassie shook her head. I don't usually do that. Invade someone's privacy. I'm sorry. But you made it easy for me, Sheriff. It was Ben who said, because he was acting like an ass. Cassie smiled slightly, but didn't look at him. No. That just made it easy for me to try to read him. You're simple, Sheriff. You think loudly. Ben had to laugh, and after a moment, even Matt smiled. Well, stop listening, will you? I didn't listen very closely, she promised him, and I'll try not to do it again. You just made me mad. Matt nodded slowly. Okay. I admit that little parlor trick was fairly convincing. And if those references of yours pan out, it's another point in your favor. But I'm still not a believer, Miss Neal. All I ask is that you keep an open mind. She glanced at Ben, then added, and give me a chance. Maybe I can help. Maybe I can't. But I will try if you want me to. Can you tap into this guy directly? You said it required a connection, which obviously already exists. If he were sitting right in front of me, I probably could. But for me to reach out over distance and try to tap into his mind when I don't know who he is or where he is, that's difficult. I'd need something of his, something he touched, something I could touch physically. What about something Becky was wearing? He touched her. Ben thought Cassie's face tightened, but her voice remained calm. We found out that's dangerous for me, to touch the belongings of a murder victim, especially the clothing worn during the crime. I connect with the strongest, most recent emotions permeating that clothing. The moment of greatest terror. Usually that's the moment of death. What happened when you tried it? Ben asked. Matter-of-factly, she answered. It was like falling into a deep black well. I didn't have the strength to pull myself out. If someone hadn't been there to break the physical connection, I don't think I would have made it. As it was, I was in a coma for a week. And afterward, it was like all the psychic pathways in my mind had been cut or burned out. It was 6 months before I got my abilities back. She paused, then added almost wistfully, "It was so quiet. It was the first time I could understand how normal people sense things." After a moment of silence, Matt said, "So you need something belonging to the killer. Something he touched that wouldn't have been affected by her death." She nodded. "The coin might work." Matt stiffened and shot a look at Ben, who spoke immediately. "I didn't tell her." Cassie said, "I broke the connection before she died, but it came back faintly a little while later, when he put her in the woods, when he posed her like that. It's how I knew where you'd find her, and I saw him put the coin into her hand." "What do you think it means?" Ben asked her. "The coin." "I think it has something to do with her worth in his eyes. It was a silver dollar, wasn't it?"
"It was," Matt said. "No prints."
"Yes, he was very careful about not leaving traceable evidence, so the coin itself probably won't lead you to him." Cassie frowned as she looked at Ben. "Her worth in his eyes. How he posed her, the coin. The way he taunted her before he killed her. He thought she was a whore.
She wasn't, Matt objected immediately. She was just a kid.
Cassie's eyes fixed on the sheriff, and she spoke gently. What she actually was didn't matter to him. In his mind, she was a whore. If you want to find him, you have to figure out how his mind works.
Yeah, I know. Matt sighed heavily. But I don't have to like it.
Not much fun trying to think like a madman, is it?
Matt looked at her. You've made your point. Cassie didn't push it.
Do you have the coin?
Maybe this isn't such a good idea, Ben said. Today, I mean. Cassie, you said you were awake most of the night. You must be tired.
He didn't add that she was visibly exhausted. I'd like to try, Judge.
I wish you'd call me Ben.
She glanced at him and nodded, but spoke to the sheriff. I'd like to try, if you have the coin. Matt opened the center drawer of his desk and brought out a small, clear plastic bag labeled Evidence. He pushed it across the desk to Cassie. She didn't touch it immediately, but instead sent Ben another quick glance. I'll need a lifeline.
A what?
A lifeline. Somebody to talk me through. Keep me focused. Keep me from going too deep.
What happens if you go too deep?
Cassie smiled faintly. I don't come back. Ben looked at Matt, who lifted an eyebrow silently, then back at her.
Okay. What do I do?
Cassie reached for the bag. Just keep talking to me. If I make a connection, don't let go. Her trust disturbed him, but Ben nodded. Either seeing or sensing his uneasiness, she said reassuringly, I'll make the connection as shallow as I can this time, just to find out if there's anything there. If this coin didn't belong to him, or wasn't in his possession for a while, there may not be much I can get. Ben watched as she opened the bag and slid the coin out onto her palm. Her head bent and her eyes closed as she began turning the coin in her fingers. It was what someone would do when she was trying to identify something by touch alone, probing the shape and texture of a thing.
Cassie,
Ben said, when he thought the silence had lasted too long. Her face turned a little toward him in a clear and instant response to his voice. She was even more pale than she had been before, so much so that it startled Ben. But her voice was steady when she slowly said, This was his. It was part of a collection. And he has more, laid out in a row. There was a place for the dollar, but now that's empty. There was a set. He still has a 50-cent piece, a quarter, a dime, a nickel, and a penny.
Does he mean to use them all? Ben asked.
I don't know, she winced. It's difficult to touch his mind. He's tired, drained. He's looking at the coins, but I don't know what he's thinking or feeling.
Matt spoke then,
his voice low and filled with the fascinated suspicion of a man unwillingly impressed by the show, but still searching for the wizard behind the curtain.
Can she see what's around him? Cassie, can you see what's around him? Can you describe where he is?
Not really. It's dark. He likes the dark. His head doesn't hurt so much in the dark.
Is it a room?
I think so. But I don't see any furniture. Just the coins laid out in a row. Black velvet behind them. All his attention is focused on them. It's like he's mesmerized. Almost in a trance. Cassie shook her head suddenly and opened her eyes. That's all. That's all I get. She slid the coin back into its bag and pushed it across the desk to Matt. I should try again in a day or two. Right now he's too distant, too drained. Matt glanced down at the notes he'd made on a legal pad.
Part of a collection.
Do you think he collects coins? Could be. The ones he had laid out before him are definitely important to him. I know that. She sounded tired.
Are you all right?
Ben asked her. I'll be fine.
But are you all right now?
She looked at him, and he felt the difference. The warmth of that direct gaze was less than it had been, as though some furnace of energy inside her had used up too much fuel, and now burned dangerously low. It's draining. But I'll be fine. To Matt, she said, I'm sorry I couldn't be more help. This time. Matt looked up from the legal pad, his face grim. Is there anything else you can tell me about him? Anything at all? Just what I'd already told you and Judge... you and Ben. I don't believe he's killed before, but I think he will again. He has the taste of it now, and he likes it. She paused. There's something young about his mind, about the way he thinks. Guessing, I'd say he's still in his 20s.
Cassie shrugged.
And then there's what a profiler would probably tell you. White male, between 24 and 32. Probably single and unlikely to be involved with a woman. Probably came from an abusive background, and undoubtedly had at least one domineering parent. Probably his mother. Sexual problems. Possibly impotence. He's found a way to achieve sexual gratification, and that's important to him. The ritual worked. The way she was posed, the coin in her hand. Those are things you'll find at the next scene. His M.O., in that way, is probably established.
What about the weapon? Matt asked.
We didn't find the knife. Will he use it again? It's a guess, but I don't think how they die is as important to him as how they're found. He may not use the same means next time. She gestured wearily. But I'm not sure.
Come on, Ben said, rising. I need to get you home.
He had to fight the instinct to reach out and offer his hand. Cassie got up. I'll wait outside. The sheriff wants to talk to you.
Stop doing that, Matt said as he also got to his feet.
I'm sorry. You were thinking loudly again. She offered him a small smile, then left the office, closing the door quietly behind her.
Well?
Ben said. Matt shook his head.
I still don't know if I buy any of this. She's reading you like a book.
Yeah, yeah. And a fake fortune teller can read a total stranger pretty well just with body language.
It's a skill, Ben, and not a paranormal one. Did your body language tell her about Abby Montgomery? It sure as hell never told me. And be careful with that, will you?
Matt ignored the warning.
I don't know how she knew about me and Abby, but I'm still not convinced. My investigation of this murder is going by the book. Most murder victims know they're killers, so family and friends have to be checked out. Co-workers, classmates, the usual drill. We'll look for witnesses who might have seen Becky talking to somebody in the last day or two. We'll check out her background and recent history, look for connections, for motives. What we will not do is start thinking we've got a serial killer on the basis of one crime.
I can't tell you how to do your job.
Matt grunted.
Why stop now? Ben smiled, but said,
What have you told Eric?
Eric Stevens published the local daily newspaper. Bare facts. That Becky was murdered. With any luck at all, word won't get around about how she was found, or about the coin. I sure as hell don't expect a copycat killer, not around here. But the less the public knows about the details, the less likely we are to have a panic on our hands.
Maybe they should panic, Ben said soberly. Matt, if we do have a serial killer...
If we do, I'll slap a curfew on this town and have all the girls escorted by family, or traveling by twos at all times. I'm not afraid to scare the hell out of them, Ben. I just won't do it needlessly.
Let's hope you won't have to, Ben said.
Hi. Cassie, who had been leaning back against a decorative lamppost on the sidewalk in front of the sheriff's department, with her face turned up to the mild February sun, looked around at the greeting and blinked to focus. She found herself being studied by a smiling woman maybe a few years older than herself, a very attractive blue-eyed blonde.
"Hi."
"Excuse me. I didn't mean to bother you, but you remind me of someone. Alexandra Melton. Any relation?" "She was my aunt." "I'm Cassie Neal." Her voice was friendly, but she kept her hands on the post behind her. "Ah, that explains the resemblance. I'm Jill Kirkwood. Nice to meet you. I knew your aunt, though not very well, I'm afraid. I own the craft store across the street there, and she came in occasionally."
"She must have liked you," Cassie commented.
"Because she came in the store?"
"No," Cassie smiled. "Because she didn't do crafts."
Jill Kirkwood blinked. "But she bought things. Supplies. And all kinds of kits."
"I know. I found them in her house. In a trunk in a spare room. As far as I can tell, she never even opened any of the kits."
After a moment, Jill laughed. "I'll be damned. I figured she had a house full of the stuff by now, even though she never brought anything in to show me, the way most of my customers do."
"As I said, she must have liked you."
"I know I liked her. She was...
odd?"
"Different." Jill smiled. "She told me once where I could find a ring I'd lost. She said she had a knack for things like that. And she was right. The ring was right where she said it would be."
Whatever Cassie might have responded to that was prevented by the arrival of Ben, who joined them on the sidewalk.
"Hi, Jill," he said.
"Ben, have you met..."
"Yes, Cassie and I have met. As a matter of fact, I'm giving her a ride back to her house."
"Oh? Well, then, I won't keep you."
She smiled at Cassie.
"Nice meeting you. Come into the store sometime, if you're more interested in crafts than Miss Melton was."
"It was nice meeting you," Cassie said with a smile, not committing herself any further.
"Bye, Ben."
"Jill."
Cassie walked slightly ahead of him to his Jeep. She didn't say anything until they were inside and heading down Main Street. Then mildly, she said, "If you'd come out of the sheriff's department a few minutes later, I might have had a new friend."
"What?"
"Jill Kirkwood. I liked her."
Ben shot her a glance. "Good. She's a nice lady."
"But she doesn't like me. Not now."
"Why not?"
"Because of you. Some ex-lovers don't want to let go. She doesn't. Other women are a threat, even without reason."
Ben was silent for a moment.
"Now I know how Matt felt. It's a little unnerving to be an open book."
"You aren't," Cassie said. "But Jill Kirkwood is. Her emotions were strong. They were hard to ignore. Impossible to ignore."
Again, Ben hesitated before speaking. "Can you read me?"
She shook her head, then looked at him rather curiously. "Not the way I can some, without even trying."
"Could you if you touched me?"
Instantly, he could feel her tense, almost draw in on herself.
"Probably. Usually. It's a rare person, a very rare non-psychic, who is able to shield thoughts and emotions, especially well enough to withstand physical contact. For most people, there was never a reason to learn, so they didn't." Ben held a hand out, palm up between them.
"Care to put it to the test?"
She looked at his hand, then met his eyes.
"If you don't mind, I'd rather not."
Her voice was very steady. He put his hand back on the wheel.
"I'll try not to take it personally."
"Please don't.
You noticed right away. I avoid touching people. All people. It's simpler for me. Their mental voices don't slip through my walls so easily. Think of what it's like to be in the center of a huge room filled with people, all of them talking.
The noise can be overwhelming, he agreed.
Not just the noise of thought, the jagged edges of emotions, the dark flashes of fantasy, the secrets they don't even tell themselves. She shrugged. It's just much less painful and distracting if I shield myself as much as possible. That means doing my best to keep my walls up and avoiding touch.
It's all right, Cassie. I really didn't take it personally.
Good. A silence fell, and neither of them broke it until Ben turned the Jeep into the long driveway at the Melton place.
I'll have to start thinking of this as your place rather than the Melton place, he said absently.
It doesn't feel like my place yet.
You said you'd been here only a few months.
Since the end of August. He glanced at her.
We had a lot of snow in December. It must have been lonely out here.
There's lonely, and then there's lonely. Believe me, the peace and quiet was wonderful. Being alone was just what I needed. As he stopped the Jeep near the walkway, she added, You don't have to get out. He did, anyway, and then opened the passenger door for her.
I was raised right. Always walk a lady to her front door. Cassie didn't protest again.
On the front porch, she dug in her jacket pocket for keys. I guess I didn't have to lock the door, but habit dies hard.
Ben frowned. Keep the door locked. And if you don't have a security system or a big dog around, get both. Soon. A week ago, I would have said it hardly mattered, but after what happened to Becky and what you said about her killer, this town doesn't feel safe anymore.
That really bothers you.
Of course it does.
No, I mean that's something you do take personally. Why? Because your family founded the town?
Maybe. And I'm an elected official very much concerned with the safety of the people of Salem County.
He knew he was being deliberately offhand, that he did, in fact, take this threat very personally. But since he didn't have a ready answer, and in any case wasn't given to explaining his emotions to anyone, it wasn't something he was willing to talk about. Cassie unlocked her front door. Understandable. I'll try the coin again in a day or two. In the meantime, if I pick up anything else about the killer, I'll give you or Sheriff Dunbar a call.
Do that.
She stepped into the house and turned back to face him. Thanks for the ride.
You're welcome. Cassie.
Yes? Ben heard himself say,
Jill and I, we broke up last summer, a long time ago.
I see. Neither her face nor her voice revealed anything other than polite interest.
I just wanted you to know. It's been over for months.
All right, Cassie said. Since there was no graceful way out of it, Ben just said,
See you later,
and went back to his Jeep. He wished he could have believed that Cassie watched him leave,
but he was reasonably sure she had not.
Putting the Jeep into gear, he muttered,
Jackass.
February 19th, 1999. Matt Dunbar wanted to throw something across his office, but contented himself with glaring at Kane Monroe, who had the misfortune of being Salem County's medical examiner.
So in other words, the sheriff said, you can't tell me a fucking thing I didn't already know.
Dr. Monroe wasn't about to take that attitude from somebody he'd delivered with his own hands.
Watch your language, Matthew. I did you the courtesy of coming down here to report instead of calling you to the hospital, and I'd appreciate a little respect in return.
Matt sighed and leaned back in his chair.
Right. Sorry, Doc.
I'm just a little tense about this.
Somewhat mollified, the doctor said,
I can understand that. Murder is never pretty, but this one was especially bad, especially cruel.
He nicked the artery first, let her bleed for a while before he finished the job.
Do you know what kind of knife he used?
A sharp one.
Dr. Monroe grimaced.
Fairly short blade. Could have been a pocket knife.
Great. That's just great. I figure most of the male population over the age of 12 has at least one pocket knife.
I figure you're right. Sorry, Matt. I wish I could be more help. If you want to get a forensics expert in from Charlotte, you won't put my nose out of joint. But the girl's family has already called twice asking when they can bury her.
The sheriff hesitated. No ego here, Doc. I need the truth. Do you think a forensics expert could find something you might have missed? Monroe pursed his lips for a moment in thought, but finally shook his head.
I'd have to say no. We went over her body with a magnifying glass, Matt. Sent samples of her blood off for a toxicology report. But I'll be surprised if it comes back positive for anything. No alcohol, no drugs.
Still,
I'd say she never got a chance to struggle, or was too scared to. Sure as hell never fought him. No skin or tissue under her nails, no defensive wounds. She sat there with her hands bound behind her, probably with a belt, as I told you. And he cut her throat, and she died.
But not in the woods.
No, there wasn't enough blood there.
Any idea where?
Nope. Have you checked her house?
Of course. Her parents never heard a sound, and the family dog, being old and deaf, never barked. We didn't find a sign of forced entry, but her folks say she usually slept with the window open, even in winter.
So you're thinking he just climbed in the window and persuaded her to get dressed and go with him?
Matt scowled. Maybe. But I don't really like that possibility. You say time of death was around 2 o'clock Thursday morning?
About that.
Then there's a chance he was waiting for her at her house when she came in late Wednesday night and got her before she could unlock the front door. Her bed wasn't made, but her mother said she often didn't make it, so we have no way of knowing if she actually came in and went to bed.
Who was she out with?
A group of friends. They all left that club out on the highway just after midnight and headed home in their individual cars. Becky was alone when she drove off in hers.
I've kept her clothes as evidence, of course, in case you want her friends to take a look and say if it was what she was wearing when she was with them.
Matt grimaced. Yeah, okay. But it wouldn't be conclusive, since she could have gotten up out of bed and put on the clothes she'd worn earlier. Doc Monroe got to his feet.
So what do I tell her folks?
Matt pushed the warning of a psychic out of his mind. Let them schedule the funeral.
Okay. I'll send my report along tomorrow. Get one of your boys to come over and collect her clothes and the bits of grass and leaves we found on her.
Matt considered reminding the doctor that his deputy force was made up of roughly 40% girls. But in the end, he just let it slide. I'll send somebody over this afternoon.
Good enough.
Matt was left alone in his office with his thoughts. And none of them were pleasant.
She shouldn't have done that. Bitch. Why did she have to do that? My head hurts. I'm still tired, and my head hurts. But I can't let her get away with it. She has to pay. They all have to pay. They'll never laugh at me again.
The knocking at her front door on Friday afternoon didn't surprise Cassie. She'd been expecting him. Sooner or later. She went to the door and opened it. Hi, she said to Ben. He was carrying a manila folder, and his face was set in grim lines. May I come in? Sure. She idly wondered whom he'd gotten to research for him. Janice, probably. She looked quite efficient. 3 days. Not bad. Most of the furniture was back in the living room, since she'd finished the painting and refinishing, so she led the way there. She left the entire sofa for him, sitting down in a wing chair at right angles to it. "Have a seat." He didn't. Instead, he opened the folder, took out a sheet of paper, and handed it to her.
"Care to explain this?"
It was a copy of a newspaper story taken from microfilm. There was a not very good photo of her much younger self, looking frightened. And headlines. Big headlines. Serial killer targets psychic. Chapter 4. "Did Janice find this for you?" Cassie asked.
"Yes."
"You don't pay her enough. That article was buried. The wire services never picked it up." Cassie put the sheet of paper on the coffee table and pushed it toward him, then made herself comfortable in the chair, sitting sideways with knees drawn up. He finally sat down on the sofa so that they were on eye level again. He reached for the paper and held it.
"According to this," he said, "a little more than 10 years ago, your mother was the one helping the police look for a killer. But before she could help them find him, he found her and killed her."
Cassie drew a breath and said tonelessly, "He didn't just kill her. He butchered her. She was home alone since I was away on a school trip. There was no one to... Here. He took his time killing her. They never let me go back into the house, but I understand there was blood everywhere." She held on to her detachment simply because there was no other way to remember or speak of such horrors. Ben seemed to understand that.
"You had to deal with that alone? Didn't you have any other family out there? The article says your father had been killed in a car wreck a couple of years before."
"My only other family was Aunt Alex, and she never replied to the telegram about Mother's death."
Cassie shrugged.
"I was 18, a legal adult. I handled what I had to, and I went on. There was insurance, enough to invest and provide a fair income while it put me through college. It took 2 more years, but the house eventually sold."
"And all your roots were gone?"
"My roots were gone the night Mother was killed." Ben drew a breath.
"This article doesn't say anything about you also being psychic."
"No. The police were kind enough and smart enough to keep that to themselves. They wanted my help."
"You mean they asked you to help them find the man who had murdered your mother?"
"Yes."
"My God. Did you?"
"Yes."
"It must have been unimaginably painful for you."
Cassie hesitated. "Remember when I told you and the sheriff about what happened when I touched the clothing of a murder victim to try to connect to the killer?"
"It put you in a coma. Damn near killed you."
"It was Mother's clothing I touched."
"Jesus," Ben muttered. "Cassie..."
"They had guards around me at the hospital, and for months after I got out. Their fear was that the killer would be able to target me as he had my mother, through the psychic connection I had made very briefly when I touched Mother's clothes. But either it hadn't been a very strong connection, or he just wasn't interested, because he never came after me in all those months. By the time I finally got my abilities back, he'd killed 6 more people, so I had to try again. Had to risk drawing his attention to me."
"What happened?"
"They got him." Her voice was matter of fact. "He was executed about 3 years ago."
"But before they got him, did you draw his attention?"
"I was much younger then," Cassie said. "Inexperienced. I didn't know how to keep the connection shallow, to get into another mind without revealing my own presence."
"Did you draw his attention?"
She grimaced slightly. "Yes."
"What happened?"
"Nothing happened, Ben,"
He came after me, and the police were waiting for him.
They used you as bait.
Cassie shook her head. It wasn't that calculated. I touched his mind too deeply. I realized it, and I told the police he'd probably come after me. They protected me and caught him. End of story.
Ben leaned forward with his elbows on his knees and stared at her.
End of story, my ass. Why the hell didn't you tell Matt and me that in touching this maniac's mind, you could be drawing his attention, making yourself a target? Don't you think that's something we needed to know?
Sheriff Dunbar doesn't believe I can touch the maniac's mind, she reminded him dryly. Assuming there even is a maniac, and not just a garden variety one-time impulse killer, which is what the sheriff believes, what he wants to believe. And you have your doubts, both about my abilities and whether there'll be another murder. Her shoulders rose and fell briefly. Besides, I've learned a lot in 10 years. It's been a long, long time since I was at risk in that way. I know what I'm doing now.
But catching his attention is still a possibility.
A very slight one.
And you're living way the hell out here, alone, without even a deadbolt on the front door. Jesus, Cassie. If you'd told us, at least we could have taken steps to keep you safe. A security system, a dog, a gun.
I don't know how to use a gun. I don't want to know. And you may have noticed that I'm fine.
Now? But what happens if you tap into this guy again?
I'll make sure he doesn't know I'm there.
And if you make a mistake? If he realizes you can watch everything he does when he's committing a murder?
He won't.
But what if he does?
Cassie drew a breath. Ben, I came to terms with that threat a long time ago. I had to. It's a risk I have to take. All I can do is be careful, and I've learned how to be.
I don't like it, Cassie.
You don't have to like it. It's my risk to take. She made sure her voice was calm and sure.
I know that, damn it.
Fooled them again. Cassie wondered how much longer she could do that. Could fool those around her into believing that taking the risk of inviting a psychopath into her mind, into her soul, didn't scare her half to death. A little longer, maybe. Trying to distract him, she glanced at the manila folder he'd laid on the coffee table. What else is in there?
Not much. Sketchy background information, school records, that sort of thing. As far as the official record is concerned, you've led a quiet, unexceptional life.
It was amazing, Cassie thought. How little of someone's life could be revealed by official record, and how much lay hidden. I guess Sheriff Dunbar has checked out my references by now.
Yeah.
And still doesn't believe I can do what I claim.
He's hard-headed. It's his biggest fault.
Most cops consider that a necessary character trait. She smiled, and saw that Ben was watching her steadily. It was unnerving. He should look like a judge, dammit. Silver-haired and forbidding. Instead, if he had celebrated his 40th birthday, Cassie would have been surprised. There wasn't a single silver thread among the dark ones, and there was youthful energy and strength in the way he moved and carried himself. Along with that, he possessed a warmth and empathy so strong she felt it reaching out to her. Rare. That was so rare. Especially among men, that ability and willingness to feel the pain of another human being. But Ben could do it, even though she doubted it was a skill he enjoyed. That was why this was going to tear him to pieces.
Cassie?
She blinked, then conjured another smile. I was just thinking that I hope Sheriff Dunbar is right. I hope that poor girl's death was an isolated incident, and that he finds her killer quickly.
But you don't believe he will?
No. I'm afraid not.
Neither do I.
Ben picked up the folder, returned the copy of the newspaper article to it, and got to his feet.
I have an appointment in an hour, so I'd better go.
Cassie walked with him to the front door. I guess you'll tell the sheriff what you found out about my mother.
Not if you don't want me to. But I think he should know, Cassie.
She opened the front door. Okay. Tell him what you like. Ben hesitated.
You know, there's something I don't think you've considered.
Oh? What's that?
You're not in L.A. now, protected by the sheer number of strangers all around you. This is a small town, Cassie. Not so small that absolutely everyone knows everyone else, but small enough. And people talk. Your trips to Matt's office and to mine have been and will be noted. Eventually, word will get out about your abilities. So even if you do manage not to alert the killer when you're in his mind, chances are that sooner or later he's still going to know who you are. And you won't be a disembodied voice in his mind. You'll be a flesh-and-blood person with an address in the phone book and no deadbolt on your front door.
After a moment, Cassie said, I'll keep that in mind.
And nothing's changed?
No. Nothing's changed. I have to do this. I have to. His hand lifted slightly, as though he would touch her, but then it fell when she tensed visibly.
I'll see you later, Cassie.
Bye, Ben. This time he had the sure knowledge that she stood in the open doorway and watched him drive away. But it didn't make him feel good.
It didn't make him feel good at all.
Maybe she really is psychic. Abby Montgomery banked the pillows behind her and sat up in bed, absently drawing the sheet up over her naked breasts. Matt Dunbar sat on the edge of the bed to put his socks and shoes on.
I don't believe in that shit.
Then how did she know about us?
A lucky guess. Hell, maybe she saw you slipping in here the other day. But she did not read my mind.
Abby was familiar with her lover's stubbornness. Usually it amused her, just as his occasional macho posturing amused her. She had good reason to know that despite both, he had a generous nature and a heart, as the saying went, like a marshmallow. But today, the reminder of how bullheaded he could be made her uneasy. Matt, if she can help find Becky's killer.
I don't know that she can. The cops out in L.A. gave her a glowing recommendation. But when I pushed, the detective I talked to finally admitted that she'd sent them down a few blind alleys and that those detours were costly.
Most conventional investigations do the same thing, don't they? I mean, you always explore at least a few possibilities that don't pan out in the end.
Yeah. But it's a hell of a lot easier to explain why you followed a lead if you've got something solid to point to. Anything a so-called psychic tells you is about as substantial as fog and just as quick to vanish.
He shook his head.
No, I just don't buy it, Abby. She must have seen us together, and that's how she knew.
In public. We barely look at each other in public. And nobody saw me slipping in here to meet you, Matt. I'm always careful, and you know it. He looked at her quickly, hearing the slight tremor.
Honey, has Gary been bothering you again? Because I can sure as hell get a restraining order against him. You know that.
She shook her head. No, he hasn't been around lately. Besides, I don't want to do anything to annoy him, at least until the divorce is final.
That's only a month away, Abby. Matt smiled. And once it's final, it'd be nice to be able to take you out in public.
Abby leaned toward him and wreathed her arms around his neck. It would be very nice. Just let's wait and see. Okay, Matt? I don't know how Gary will react when it's final. His mouth tightened, but his hands were gentle as they stroked her arms. I've been as patient as I know how, Abby, but there's no way I'm prepared to keep our lives on hold indefinitely just to keep Gary from blowing a fuse.
I can handle him.
It isn't indefinitely. I just want to avoid trouble if at all possible, Matt.
There won't be any trouble. I'll just kick his ass.
Abby smiled. Let's wait and see. Another month. That isn't so long, is it?
That depends on what you're waiting for.
He kissed her, taking his time about it, then eased her back onto the pillows and leaned over her.
I'm waiting for something I've wanted for a long, long time. You.
You've got me. All the rest is just a formality. He brushed a strand of bright red hair back from her face.
I also want Gary out of your life, with no excuses to call you or knock on your door. I want to have the right to tell him to go to hell.
Given the chance, you'll do that whether you have the right or not, she said dryly.
True. Matt kissed her again.
Just be patient a little while longer.
Okay, okay.
He sat up, then got to his feet.
I've got to get back to the office.
Matt,
she hesitated,
this psychic,
so-called.
Did you ever hear the rumors about her aunt? About Miss Melton?
What about her?
Well, that she knew things. Things she shouldn't have been able to know.
Matt stared down at her, brows raised. I heard talk. So what? She was a loner, kept to herself, hardly came into town. And when she did, she barely spoke to anyone and was usually dressed oddly for a woman her age. People were bound to talk. It doesn't mean anything, Abby.
Abby smiled. I guess not. But, Matt, if Cassie Neal can help you, let her. Don't ignore what she has to say.
You don't usually tell me how to do my job, he noted dryly.
I'm not now, but I know how stubborn you can be. You've made up your mind she's a phony, haven't you?
Maybe.
Admit it, Matt. You wouldn't even have given her the time of day if Ben hadn't insisted. You know he's no gullible fool.
No, but he isn't thinking with his head. Not where Cassie Neal is concerned. Beats me what he sees in her, but the lady has certainly grabbed his attention.
Abby opened her mouth, then closed it and shook her head. After that brief pause, she merely said, Just don't let a preconceived idea get in your way, Matt. That's all I'm saying.
No, I won't.
He bent and kissed her one last time, then laughed a little as he headed for the door.
I had no idea you believed in that stuff.
When she was alone in the bedroom, Abby gazed toward the door and murmured, Oh, I believe in it, Matt. I believe in it. Ivy Jameson was having a bad day. In fact, she'd had a bad week. On Monday, she'd had the unpleasant duty of taking her mother's old cat to the vet to have him euthanized. Wednesday had come the notice from the North Carolina Department of Revenue, claiming she owed back taxes. Yesterday, she'd had to tear the hide off a TV repairman who obviously didn't know his ass from a 3-foot hole in the ground. And today, on this pleasant, warm Friday afternoon in late February, she was being told that her 10-year-old car was on its last wheels, so to speak. A new transmission, Dale Newton said, consulting his clipboard. The brakes are shot. Universal joint. The left front tire's bald.
Enough?
She glared at him.
How much?
The mechanic shifted uneasily.
I haven't worked up an estimate yet, Mrs. Jameson. You just asked me to check it out and see if it needed any work. It does. There's more.
She waved him to a stop.
Just work up the estimate and then call me. But you'd better bear in mind, Dale Newton, that my late husband loaned you the money to get this garage going 15 years ago. I expect that to make a difference. I expect some consideration for a poor widow.
Yes, ma'am. Newton smiled weakly. I'll have the estimate ready in a couple of hours.
You do that.
I can give you a loaner, Mrs. Jameson.
No. I hate driving a strange car. I'll walk across the street to Shelby's and call a taxi.
I have a phone, Mrs. Jameson.
I realize that. What you don't have is coffee. Good day, Mr. Newton.
Ma'am.
Newton watched her walk away, her back ramrod straight, and he wondered, not for the first time, if old Kenneth Jameson had died because he'd been sick or just plain tired. Ivy left Newton's garage on the corner of Main Street and First, walked a block toward the center of town, and then crossed the street to Shelby's restaurant, a landmark in Ryan's Bluff that had once been a wonderful example of the Art Deco style, and last modernized in the 60s. It had been several times redecorated through the years, and all the individual touches of various owners had left it somewhat garish. It still had a Formica counter and swivel stools at the front, and boasted clear plastic tablecloths over the linen ones. It was a place Ivy visited regularly, and just as habitually criticized, a one-time hot spot that had seen better days but still offered good plain food and hot coffee right up until midnight, 7 days a week.
"This coffee is too strong, Stuart,"
Ivy told the young man behind the counter.
"Yes, Mrs. Jameson, I'll make fresh." "You do that. And put in a pinch of salt to draw the bitterness."
"Yes, ma'am."
When Cassie answered a second knock on her front door late Friday afternoon, she was surprised to find a stranger standing there, a young man wearing a dark jumpsuit with the name Dan on one pocket and SafeNet Security on the other. He was holding a clipboard and spoke politely.
"Miss Neal?"
"I'm Dan Crowder, SafeNet Security. My partner and I are here to install your security system."
She looked past him to a white van in her driveway with the security company logo on its side and another clean-cut and uniformed young man standing beside it.
"My security system?"
"Yes, ma'am. Judge Ryan sent us."
He certainly hadn't wasted any time.
Dan smiled reassuringly.
"Judge Ryan said you were to call him if you had any doubts, Miss Neal."
Cassie didn't call Ben. She called the security company. As she'd expected, Dan's story was confirmed. Cassie toyed with the idea of sending Dan and his partner away, but in the end let them in so they could commence their work, because Ben had been right about one thing. In a small town, it was only a matter of time before the wrong person discovered what she could do.
Ben?
On the point of entering the building next door to the courthouse where his office was located, Ben paused and turned to see Jill Kirkwood approaching him. He couldn't help remembering Cassie's assertion that Jill had not accepted their breakup, but still managed to smile and greet her with the same low-key easiness he'd held on to since they'd broken it off. Since he had broken it off.
"Hi, Jill. What's up?"
"Is there any news on who killed Becky Smith?"
He was only a little surprised that she asked. In the brief time it had taken him to walk the two blocks from the downtown office where he'd had an earlier appointment, he'd already been stopped 3 times by worried citizens asking the same anxious question. Still, it wasn't like Jill to be much interested in crime, even a particularly vicious one.
"Nothing new that I know of," he told her. "Matt and his deputies are working on it."
"Does he know that Becky thought she was being followed?"
She thought. "How do you know that?"
"She told me. Came into the store one day last week. Wednesday, I think it was. We got to talking, and she mentioned she'd caught a glimpse of somebody watching her. She sort of laughed about it. Said something about having a secret admirer who didn't want to show his face. She wasn't worried about it, so I didn't give it a second thought."
"So he did watch her before. Another bullseye for Cassie. You'd better tell Matt about it, Jill,"
I don't think he knows, unless somebody else told him in the last day or so.
All right. I'll go see him. She smiled. I was glad to meet Cassie Neal. I liked her aunt.
Yeah, so did I.
She hasn't been in town long, has she?
Cassie? About 6 months, I think.
Oh. I just didn't remember seeing her before yesterday.
I'm not surprised. She seems as much of a loner as Miss Melton was.
Seems? You don't know her very well?
I met her Tuesday.
He felt a flash of annoyance at being questioned, but trusted he kept the reaction out of his face. Jill laughed a little, with the bright smile and artificial ease of someone aware of crossing the line.
Sorry, I didn't mean to pry.
Obviously, his poker face wasn't as good as he'd thought.
Ben said,
"Don't be ridiculous. Look, why don't you go and tell Matt what you know? He needs to hear it. The sooner we get this bastard behind bars, the better it'll be for everyone in town."
Okay. I'll see you later, Ben.
Sure.
For just an instant, as she turned away, he considered warning her to be careful, but cast off the impulse as ridiculous and unnecessary. What could he say, after all? Watch out for strangers following you? She was a smart lady, and knowing what she did about Becky being followed, she would certainly take notice, and take steps to protect herself, if she suspected the same thing was happening to her. So Ben watched her walk away, and said nothing. Laughing at me. I can hear them. Watching me. Eyes following me. Gotta stop them. Gotta make them pay. My head hurts. I'll show them. My feet hurt. Gotta slow down. Gotta... Look at that one. So proud of herself. So sure she's the best. She deserves... My head hurts so bad. Eyes watching me. I wonder if they know. Blood smells like coins. Chapter 5. February 21st, 1999. When Cassie heard the scream, it was so loud in her head that she dropped the glass she'd been holding and clapped her hands over her ears.
"No,"
she whispered helplessly. Without her volition, her eyes closed, and behind the lids flashed whorls of vivid colors streaked with black. A second scream made her jerk and hurt her throat.
"No. Please. Please. Don't hurt me."
Abruptly, Cassie was somewhere else. Someone else. She felt the painful constriction of something around her wrists, felt a sharp edge at her back, and cold hardness beneath her. She couldn't see. It was all black. But then the bag over her head was jerked off.
"Please, don't hurt me. Please, please don't hurt me. Please don't..."
The mask he wore was horrible. The character might have been from some recent slasher movie, the face a human one, but terribly distorted, and it made her shock intensify, her terror soar.
"Please don't hurt me. Oh, God, please don't. I won't tell anyone, I promise. I swear. Just let me go, please."
For an eternal instant, Cassie was paralyzed, completely trapped in the woman's spiraling emotions. Shock, wild terror, despair, and the cold, cold certainty that she was going to die soon and horribly clawed at her. Through the woman's tear-blurred eyes, she saw that eerie mask loom above her, saw the butcher knife in his gloved hand, and her throat hurt with gasping breaths and whimpers and raw screams. "You'll never laugh at me again," he rasped, and his arm lifted, the knife gleaming dully.
"No, Oh, Jesus!
As his arms started downward in a vicious arc, Cassie desperately wrenched herself free of the doomed woman. But she wasn't fast enough to save herself completely. She felt the first hot agony of the knife piercing her breast, and everything went black.
Ben.
Matt?
What is it?
Meet me in town. Ivy Jameson's place. Ben switched the phone to his other hand and checked his watch.
Now? It's Sunday afternoon. She'll be... She's dead, Ben.
Ben didn't even ask how. Matt's tone told him all he needed to know.
I'm on my way, he said.
10 minutes later, he parked the Jeep behind Matt's cruiser and one other in the driveway of the Jameson house on Rose Lane, just 2 streets behind Main Street. It was usually a quiet neighborhood, the big old houses sitting peacefully on manicured lawns, the older residents happy to be no more than a short, pleasant afternoon walk from downtown. Ben noticed that several of those older residents were on their front porches, staring at him as he got out of his Jeep. Although they were too polite, or too frightened, to venture closer to Ivy's house, it was obvious that their interest was intense. One of Matt's deputies was standing by the front door and opened it for Ben as he came up on the porch.
Judge.
The sheriff's inside. He looked a bit green around the gills. Ben went into the house. He was familiar with it, as he was most of the homes of the more politically active citizens of Ryan's Bluff. Ivy Jameson's vote had been one of the hardest to get. From the spacious entrance hall, the staircase rose to the second floor. The formal dining room opened to the right, an equally formal living room to the left, and straight ahead lay the rear of the house and the kitchen. The hardwood floor gleamed. Fresh flowers in a lovely crystal vase decorated the entrance hall table, and there was an air of stuffy dignity about the place. The two men sitting on the sofa in the formal living room spoiled the atmosphere of dignity. They were in their stocking feet, faces slack and pale with shock, and the younger one was breaking Ivy's most sacrosanct house rule by smoking a cigarette jerkily, flicking the ashes into an already full crystal candy dish on the coffee table before him. Ben knew them both. One was Ivy's brother-in-law, and the other was her nephew. Neither looked toward him, and he made no attempt to speak to them. Another deputy standing just outside the living room doorway silently gestured toward the rear of the house. He also looked queasy, and when Ben passed him, murmured,
Sheriff said to watch your step, Judge.
The floor back there is slippery. It was slippery, all right. The tile floor of the kitchen was covered in blood.
Oh, Christ,
Ben muttered as he stopped in the doorway. He had observed scenes of violence before, but not many, and nothing that had prepared him for this. Matt stood a couple of feet inside on one of the few blood-free spots on the floor.
Looks like Ivy finally pissed off the wrong person.
It was unquestionably a scene of rage. Even the white appliances were spattered with blood, and the stab wounds in Ivy's thin body were almost too numerous to count. She'd been all dressed up, probably for church earlier in the day. Her dress might have been any light color once. Now it was red. She still had one shoe on.
Notice the way he left her?
Matt asked.
Yeah,
Ben said, trying to breathe through his mouth because the smell was overpowering.
Sitting up, with her back against the leg of the work island, her hands in her lap, posed. Is there a coin?
A nickel, in her left hand. If the smell bothered Matt, it wasn't apparent. Ben gestured.
And footprints. The killer?
Among others. When she didn't show up for church or Sunday dinner afterward and didn't answer the phone, Ivy's mother sent her son-in-law and grandson over to see if anything was wrong. They came in the back door, said they were sliding all over before they knew what was happening. If we're lucky, we might get one footprint we can't match to their shoes.
Matt pointed out a bloody butcher knife on the floor a foot or so away from Ivy's body. No question about the murder weapon. He just grabbed a knife off the rack.
Forced entry.
No sign of it. And her relatives say she always locked the back door. All the doors. That she was fanatical about it.
So she must have let him in.
Looks that way. Ben backed out of the doorway.
This smell, I can't.
Matt followed him, avoiding the blood gingerly, and joined him in the small hallway outside the kitchen. Doc Monroe's on his way. So are my technical people. I took one look, called you first.
Her position? The coin? It's the same killer, Matt.
Yeah. Matt drew a breath, his face very grim. And he barely waited 3 days between killings, Ben. Worse. Becky Smith and Ivy Jameson had only two things in common. They were both white and both female. Beyond that, there are no similarities between them.
I know.
Did you notice the knife rack? We won't know for sure until her housekeeper inventories for us, but it looks like one of the big butcher knives is missing. Ben stared at his friend in silence, unwilling to give voice to any of the disturbing possibilities in his mind. Matt was less reluctant. The bastard's probably taken his next weapon from this victim.
Cute. Really cute. Jesus.
Ben muttered. Frustrated by the realization that the killer might have already chosen his next victim, too. And one more thing. Matt's voice was level. This time, your psychic didn't see it coming. By the time Ben got to Cassie's house, it was beginning to get dark. Even so, he saw her. She was sitting on the front porch, curled up in one of the two big wicker chairs placed to one side of the front door. As Ben reached her, he said,
"The security system won't do much good if you're outside it, Cassie."
His voice was sharper than he intended it to be. Almost lost in a sweatshirt several sizes too big, her jean-clad legs drawn up and her arms wrapped around them, Cassie didn't glance at him. She merely said quietly, "I had to come out here. It was... all I could smell was blood. It wasn't so bad out here." Ben moved the other chair so that it was facing hers and sat, literally placing himself in her line of vision. She still looked past him. No warm hand touched him.
"So you knew he killed again?"
"Yes." Her face was so pale, even her lips seemed drained of color.
"Why didn't you call me?"
"By the time I could, it was too late. There was nothing anyone could do for her. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
"Did you see anything this time? Anything that might help us catch this bastard?"
Cassie shook her head slowly. "No. He was wearing some kind of mask."
"How do you know that? Did he look in a mirror?"
"No. This time I didn't connect with him. I connected with her. She was crying. But I could see him. He had some kind of mask. Horrible mask. Like something a kid would wear on Halloween."
Ben frowned. "Why would he do that? He wasn't planning to leave a witness behind."
"I don't know. Except the mask made her even more frightened. Maybe that was it. Maybe he wants them to be afraid."
"Or maybe he knows you're watching."
"No."
"How can you be sure of that? If you connected with her?"
"I'm sure." Ben was silent for a moment, then said slowly,
"Why did you connect with her?"
"Maybe because I had met her briefly." Cassie's voice was growing more distant,
and her eyes had an odd, unfocused look to them.
Do you connect with the victim very often?
Not if I can help it. As dark as the mind of a killer is, the mind of his victim is almost worse. The terror and despair, the agony. Cassie shook her head again slowly. It pulls me in. They pull me in. They're so desperate, so frantic to find a way out. He stopped himself from reaching out to her, bad as he wanted to.
I'm sorry.
She shivered visibly and finally looked at him, saw him. But when her gaze touched him, it was cool rather than warm, and such a faint sensation, it was almost ghostly. I can't do it anymore. Her voice was low, hurried. I know it's the right thing to do. I know the sight gives me a responsibility, and I've always tried. But I can't do it anymore. I thought I could. I thought there had been enough time, enough peace. I thought I was strong enough, but I'm not. I can't go through it again.
Cassie.
I can't. I can't help you. I can't help myself.
You came to me, he reminded her quietly.
I know that. I wanted to help.